You're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us. Thanks for tuning in. Representing King Charles III in Canada, serving as the federal representative of the head of state, the newly appointed Governor General designate is Louise Arbour, a former human rights lawyer and Supreme Court justice. Prime Minister Mark Carney made this announcement on Tuesday, May 5th, and has stated she will be an exemplary steward of our tradition of peace, order, and good government. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook sits down with parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg to discuss what Louise Arbour brings to the role and the history behind the title. Here are Nirenberg and Seabrook in conversation. Take a listen.
Carl, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So, to start us off, Canada has recently learned that we'll soon be having a new Governor General. We learned the identity of that Governor General last week, Louise Arbour. Carl, can you give us your initial thoughts on the announcement of Louise Arbour as our next Governor General?
Well, my first initial thought was nothing like everybody else's, which was that she was a hugely qualified person in so many ways, and everybody was singing her praises. Not that she doesn't deserve that. I'm not entirely sure all the praise was quite justified and maybe a little over the top. But my immediate thought is, well, we at Rabble, and I personally happen to know her equally, I think, eminent, or in many ways equally eminent, daughter Emily Tammin. And people who follow affairs with the NDP know that Emily Tammin has been a candidate twice for the NDP here in the Ottawa area. And she also authored a report on the terrible and disastrous results of the last election for the NDP called the Tammin Report, which a lot of people have talked about and read. And she is a very decent, smart, capable person. She was also quite involved with actions around dealing with the truckers' convoy in Ottawa, and I can't quite remember exactly the details, but she is a lawyer herself, Emily Tammin, here in Ottawa. And it does somewhat surprise me, I know she has other children as well, Louise Arbour, but it does somewhat surprise me that people don't mention, oh, by the way, she has Louise Arbour has a daughter who is of some national importance and prominence, not just as a local candidate, but as a national figure in the New Democratic Party. It shows that our mainstream press doesn't pay that much attention to, our third party at the national level and a party that has had so much influence and importance in Canadian history.
Mm-hmm. And for the appointment, do you think that it's a surprise who Carney decided to go with, that he decided on Louise Arbour for this position?
It's not entirely a surprise that he chose a sober and qualified person, a lawyer and a former judge, keeping in mind that Carney is taking more seriously the constitutional role than the ceremonial role in doing that. So the Governor General performs the role of the king or queen's representative in Canada. Canada is a monarchy. Our head of state is King Charles III. But King Charles III has very little to do with Canada and every once in a while will visit and doesn't pay attention to day-to-day affairs. So we need somebody in Canada. All Commonwealth countries that are monarchies in that sense need somebody to fulfill the role. By the way, it is a role fulfilled in parliamentary democracies on the Westminster model, the British model, that aren't monarchies, such as India. It is a role in those countries that's filled by an elected president. So countries that I can think of that have some overlapping features with the British Westminster system are India, definitely, but as well Israel, in fact, and Germany. All three of those countries have either a prime minister or, in Germany's case, a chancellor who is a member of their parliament or whatever they call it, who is the head of government, and a president elected but who doesn't have much power, but has a very important constitutional role as the ultimate referee who helps determine who gets to form government in the case where there are coalitions or where there are what they call hung parliaments in Britain where nobody has a majority. So this is a role that we have not had prime ministers since the 1950s, when we had our first Canadian Governor General named by the Prime Minister of the day, rather than a British Governor General named by the British government. But since that time, it does not have seemed to have been a primary or overwhelmingly important preoccupation in the naming of a Governor General, sometimes less and sometimes more so. But in this case, I think Mark Carney has in mind that we never know. We could be headed for constitutional rough waters, and we'll need a Governor General who can act as the arbiter or final decider on some thorny constitutional or parliamentary issues that may come across her desk, and who will have the confidence of the Canadian people and credibility. When she makes a decision, she won't be second-guessed.
And for our listeners, obviously, you know, as you mentioned, the Governor General, largely a ceremonial role. Legislation does not become law without the Governor General's rubber stamp on it. But beyond those duties and those powers, what else is within the Governor General's purview?
Well, the Governor General is also the, again, ceremonial head of the armed forces, but the official head of the armed forces. And the Governor General does have a responsibility not just for legislation, but when the Parliament is dissolved, when a Prime Minister seeks to dissolve Parliament and call election or prorogue Parliament, and proroguing Parliament means ending the current session, everything disappears and you start over afresh with a new session of Parliament. All the legislation that had been pending is gone and you just start from zero again. The Governor General has to approve that. Now, there was a case with Michael Jean, who was a Governor General back and originally appointed by Paul Martin and then in Stephen Harper's time. You may remember that Stephen Harper wanted to prorogue Parliament in 2008 because he was facing a confidence vote that he would have lost. The opposition, even though we'd only had an election maybe weeks earlier, Harper puts poison pills into his first piece of legislation that the opposition couldn't accept. And they planned to get together, the NDP and Liberals, and defeat, and the Bloc Québécois, the three of them. And they had enough seats to defeat the government. And they had a whole plan to propose a coalition government of the NDP and Liberals supported by the Bloc Québécois. So to avoid having an unnecessary or an election so soon after the previous one. And so Harper got the idea, I'll dodge the bullet by not letting Parliament come back, proroguing. And he went to the Governor General, Michael Jean, and he requested prorogation. There was lots of controversy among experts across the country. Lots of people said, Michael Jean has the right to tell him, this has never happened before. We never had a government get elected in October and prorogue in December. I mean, the parliament's met for a few days. What are you, you're only proroguing to avoid a vote. But the people democratically elected all these members of parliament, and they want to have a chance to vote on this legislation you're proposing. They say they're going to vote non-confidence in you. They've announced that. So maybe you have an option. One, you can withdraw that legislation, propose something else, negotiate with them so that they won't vote you out of office. Or you can take your medicine and let them vote. And then it's up to the Governor General to consider later on whether we will have a coalition government that will replace you or whether we have to have an election. That's a second decision. In any case, the problem for Michael Jean was that she was one of these governors general, I should say, chosen more for the ceremonial side and for what she represented. She was the first black person chosen as governor general, a person born outside of Canada, like her predecessor, Adrienne Clarkson from Haiti, you know, a prominent and much loved media personality. But she admitted herself that she wasn't a constitutional expert. She was a journalist, not a lawyer, and had no background in that. So had to take advice. And so I think another governor general, maybe had Louise R. Boer been governor general then, she might have said, look, normally a prime minister gets to prorogue whenever he or she or they want to do it. But in this case, it seems to be breaking the rules. It seems to be breaking the principles of parliamentary democracy. So we're not going to let you do it. But Michael Jean, what she did is made Harper sit there in a meeting for an hour until she finally decided to let him do it. So as though to say, I, as Governor General, and many Canadians think this is a very irregular procedure and very, very undemocratic, but no Prime Minister has ever had his request for prorogation denied, so I'm going to go with precedent and allow you to do it. But stuff like that can come up.
Yeah, and of course, Louise Arbour, if she is put in a similar situation, would be speaking with the authority of someone who's been on Canada's Supreme Court and, you know, knows her constitution very well.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think so. I think maybe it was, I think, I mean, here's a statement of interest. Michael Jean is a personal friend of mine. We worked together at Radio Canada, so I only have the greatest respect for and admiration for her. And but in that sort of issue, when we had demonstrations on the street, we had people saying, you know, no coalition, the losers can't take over from the winners. I mean, this is ridiculous. Harper won the election. He should be allowed to govern. I mean, it was a very tense situation, very polarized, very divided. It was very awkward for her. She had already been somewhat criticized by old-style monarchists for being this young person not born in Canada, whose husband was a citizen of France. There was all kinds of issues surrounding her that she didn't necessarily have the full confidence of the full range of Canadian society. And she'd been in Europe at the time. She was in the Czech Republic when this happened and rushed back to deal with this crisis. So, yeah, it would have been interesting if we could rewrite history and have a person with Louise Arbour's age and experience in place of a different sort of person for Governor General.
Now, just thinking of, you know, Governors General of consequence and of their legacy, thinking of recent ones, Payette, just a few years ago, her most notable thing was resigning from office during her term. Our current Governor General, Mary Simon, I can't think of any really notable events during her term in office other than the fact that she was appointed as the first Indigenous person to be Governor General. Before that, David Johnston, I think probably his most notable thing as Governor General came after he left office with his recent report into foreign interference and how poorly that was received. Carl, what are your thoughts on people who are notable as Governor General? How do they become notable within that office?
Well, to go way back to the British time, as I want to do in history, the one Governor General, British appointed Governor General, got into real political conflict was Lord Byng. And he got into a fight with then Prime Minister Mackenzie King in the so-called King-Byng affair. And that was, again, a similar case where King was defeated had a minority government and was defeated on a vote in Parliament. He went to the Governor General, Byng. He says, okay, let's have an election. I was defeated on a vote. We'll have to have an election. He hadn't been in power that long, but it wasn't months. It was maybe a year. I don't remember. It was in the late 1920s. So at that point, Meehan, who was leader of the Conservative Party, said, no, we can get, we petitioned the Governor General to say, our party can get the confidence of the House. At that point, the balance of power was held by the Progressive Party, sometimes called the United Farmers Party, which was a kind of populist, rural-based, agrarian movement. And they didn't even consider themselves to be exactly a party. They sort of considered themselves to be a group of quasi-independents. In any case, Meehan thought he could get their support and that he could then govern and have a new government. And Byng said, well, why not? Why should we have an election where we can have another prime minister? And, King made a big issue out of it. That government didn't last. The Progressive Party, the Liberals managed to peel away progressive members who weren't very committed to anything, and they were defeated, so we did have to have an election after that. And basically, King ran against the Governor General. He said, do you want an elected government? Do you want your prime minister to be your leader, or do you want a British-appointed lord? to push us around, and he won the election. So that kind of made governors general pretty nervous about interfering in politics after that. Another notable governor general a little bit later was John Buchan, not so much for anything he did in Canada, because he was a notable person, one of the most notable people appointed by the British Crown. He was a mystery writer. He wrote The 39 Steps, which Alfred Hitchcock made into a film. So he was a person of some accomplishment outside of being Governor General of Canada. Then the first Canadian Governor General was Vincent Massey, appointed in 1950s. Very eminent person. He'd been ambassador to, or high commissioner, as we call it, to London. He'd authored the Massey Report on Arts and Culture in Canada that led to the development of CBC television, led to the creation of the Canada Council. He came from the, if anybody's heard of farm equipment called the company called Massey Ferguson, he came from that family. Or you've heard of Massey Hall in Toronto. They were very eminent, old money Ontario family. The one blot on his escutcheon, which is pretty serious, was that as High Commissioner to London, he wrote private correspondence to the government of the day saying that they should not take in Jewish refugees during and after World War II, or the lead up to World War II, because these people would not assimilate to Canadian ways and were too different from the ordinary average Canadian. They wouldn't make good Canadians somehow. So he is seen in retrospect as being a bit of an old-fashioned anti-Semite, as many people of his class and social background were at the time. So he was an interesting choice, an interesting character nonetheless, especially since it doesn't seem to have harmed his reputation, the fact that he was quite well known as an anti-Semite. There's things named after, there are schools, parks, institutions named after Vincent Massey all over this country. By the way, his brother was a Hollywood actor, Raymond Massey, who portrayed famously Abraham Lincoln in the movies, that a Canadian portraying Abraham Lincoln. And I think Michael Jean, we talked about Michael Jean, she's one governor general who really got involved off the radar in a significant policy area that connected to me, not because she happened to be a friend of mine, that was disassociated from that, but she was in the Czech Republic on a tour of Central Europe with her husband and other Canadians at the time of the prorogation issue. And visiting the Czech Republic, she insisted on meeting the Czech government, the Czech president, that she meet with the local Roma community, which no visiting foreign head of state had ever done. And there's a museum in the Czech Republic in the city of Brno, and she wanted to go there, and she wanted to invite Roma representatives from their community to the official dinner. And the government was shocked and surprised, and she absolutely insisted. And when she and her husband, Jean-Daniel Lefond, met with Roma people, they actually told them that it was possible for Roma people to come, who felt persecuted in the Czech Republic or Hungary, to come to Canada. And you didn't require a visa to travel from those countries to Canada. So they could come to Canada, get a plane ticket, come to Canada, and once landing, claim refugee status. And that was quite legal and possible, and that it became the beginning of a bit of a mini wave. We developed our own suddenly Roma community, self-consciously Roma community, for the first time in Canada following Michael Jean's visit. That people don't know about it. This is kind of behind the scenes story, and I hope nobody gets annoyed at me, but the Harper government and his Minister of Immigration, Jason Kenney, were very opposed to this. They claimed that the Roma people were from liberal democratic countries and that they suffered minor discrimination, but they weren't legitimate refugees, and that they were abusing our system and they just wanted Canadian welfare. And also they used rhetoric that really fed into the widespread prejudice against the Roma people in Canada, among people who come from those countries in Europe where people tend to be very contemptuous of them, and in those countries. So it was a way in which a governor general had an impact. And I did speak to Jean-Daniel Lefond and Michael Jean years after that, and they were sort of felt, Jean-Daniel Lefond told me, well, the prime minister said, we don't want to encourage. Why are you encouraging the people to come? He says, we're telling them the law. This is the law of Canada. This is the international refugee law. We're only telling them what their rights are under existing law. And in fact, Jason Kenney then went and rewrote refugee and immigration law to make it harder for people like the Roma to get into the country. And of course, I have a deep connection to this because I ended up making a film about the Canadian Roma community and went back to those countries from which they came to see what kind of conditions propelled them to come to Canada. So there is a case of a governor general using her position in a somewhat controversial way, which is this is maybe the first time it's being made public, so public in such a public way.
Well, I think a very interesting piece of history and in recent history in the way that that role can be used to enact some real effect and some real change. And Carl, we just have a couple of minutes left, you know, about 2 minutes. But just before we go, you know, we are gearing up for the summer, sometimes a quiet time in politics. But I'm thinking that this summer will be an exception to that rule. Is there anything in terms of the world of politics on Parliament Hill that you're keeping an eye on going into the summer?
Well, I think right now we're facing a situation where the government has decided that we're in a new era with new conditions. When the health minister, Marjorie Michel, also, by the way, originally from Haiti, was telling journalists that we're no longer going to be pursuing pharma care or dental care or a lot of the programs that we'd promised Canadians, she said, well, the conditions have changed. The government's attitude towards the changing conditions and the exigencies of having to fight Trump and the tariff problem, the threats to our sovereignty is make the poor pay. There has been not a single, everything that they're doing is reducing funding for health programs, federal the government's own health programs, reducing funding for foreign aid, cutting the public service in ways that may seriously affect the services that people who pay taxes, for instance, and have to deal with the CRA receive, and not in any way asking any wealthy person or corporation to make one penny's worth of sacrifice. In fact, one relatively significant fiscal measure that Justin Trudeau had brought in toward the end of his tenure, which was to modestly raise the capital gains tax, they got rid of that. The big pressure from the investment community in Toronto and from people involved in high-tech startups and people like that. And even they didn't try to change it. They didn't try to get rid of unwanted side effects of such legislation. Nor did they try to find other sources of revenue from wealthy people who can afford it. The cost of fighting the Trump threat is being borne entirely by those least able to pay it, and those most able to assume any measure of sacrifice are being asked to do nothing. And the question is, when are Canadians going to notice this? I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for your thoughts on that, Carl. And to read more about this and other stories and for Carl's ongoing analysis of these issues, visit rabble.ca. Go to rabble.ca/donate to support our work. And thank you so much for listening today. Carl, thanks for joining us.
Take care. Bye.
Was Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nierenberg and Rabble editor Nick Seabrook in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Carl and Nick. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's hand things back over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting with Labour news. Last Friday was May 1st, which in much of the world is celebrated as May Day, a day to celebrate workers. A protest was held in Ottawa to mark May Day. The Ottawa May Day Organizing Committee was protesting against authoritarianism, tariffs, austerity, and a rising cost of living for workers. Workers chanted, "Workers of the world unite, one planet, one fight." Protesters marched to the offices of the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries to demand an end to war profiteering. Also this week, in an article on Rabble, Scott Douglas-Jacobson interviewed Shrestha Das, a researcher advisor on gender with Amnesty International, focusing on gender, racial justice, refugees, and migrant rights. Together, they discussed Amnesty International's research on xenophobic, technology-facilitated gender-based violence against racialized migrant women and 2S LGBTQIA+ people in Canada. Online harassment continues to grow, and that harassment disproportionately targets racialized migrant women and members of the queer community. Das warned how this harassment could lead to violence, saying, quote, "What may appear at first to be isolated instances of dehumanizing language or of certain groups being painted as threats actually creates the conditions for violence. It helps justify violent action because people have been so dehumanized and portrayed as threats in the dominant idea of society." End quote. In provincial news, the Alberta government of United Conservative Premier Danielle Smith is facing a serious scandal after the names, phone numbers, and addresses of 2.9 million Albertans were leaked online. The leaked information was a part of a database of eligible voters in Alberta and was released by the Centurion Project, a group involved in organizing a petition for a separatist referendum in the province. Smith's government was tied to the scandal when it was revealed that staff members from her party were a part of an online training exercise showing how the database could be used to contact members of the public and target those who opposed the separatist movement, including former Alberta Premier Jason Kenney. The case has been referred to Elections Alberta and the RCMP for investigation. And finally, in environmental news, Dave Suzuki believes that a recent climate change conference held in Colombia will lead to positive change for the environment. The first conference on transitioning away from fossil fuels was held in Santa Marta, Colombia, from April 24th to 29th. The Santa Marta conference made clear that the global struggle against fossil fuel dependence must be understood as a part of a much longer movement of global economic justice. The Santa Marta conference leaves no doubt. Climate action requires unhinging power from foreign corporate privilege and putting it towards justice, democracy, and the communities most affected. As always, you can read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Finally, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent and diverse campus community radio from Simon Fraser University.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in